So imagine you go out and buy this precision-engineered $60,000 German Roadster.
Oh, yeah, a beautiful machine.
Right. And you park it in this nice climate-controlled garage and you just let it sit there.
Untouched.
Exactly. Only to realize later on that the machine is actually slowly destroying itself from the inside out.
Which is wild, right? Because we desperately want to believe the machine is immune to the world around it.
We really
We
do.
build these incredibly intricate systems and we just assume, their sheer mechanical superiority makes them invincible.
Yeah, like it's in a protective bubble or something.
But the moment you take a highly sensitive performance vehicle out of the laboratory and drop it into a brutal, chaotic local environment, well, that illusion shatters completely.
And that is exactly what we are getting into today. Welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Today's mission is exploring that exact collision between high-performance engineering and brutal local environments.
It's such a fascinating intersection.
It really is. So, we are analyzing a detailed technical guide published by Autoscope. Now, they are an independent European auto repair shop, and they've been serving Dallas and Plano since 1982.
That's over 40 years of local data.
Right. And the entirety of this guide focuses on the maintenance and repair of the BMW Z4, specifically in the North Texas climate.
Which serves as, honestly, the ultimate mechanical stress test. I mean, it is a hyper-specific case study,
Yeah.
but it really exposes the hidden mechanics of how environmental vulnerability compromises high-level engineering across the board.
Yeah, and for you listening, you might not even own a German car or a convertible. But if you look at how you maintain the complex systems in your own life, whether that's your home HVAC system, the servers at your job, or just your daily commuter, the psychology of degradation is exactly the same.
Oh, absolutely. It translates to everything.
And the authors of The Source frame this all around shifting your mindset, moving from reactive repair to proactive maintenance, mainly to save you from catastrophic failures.
Which is a very expensive lesson to learn the hard way.
Definitely. Okay, let's unpack this. We have this low-slung, highly sensitive rear-wheel drive roadster going up against the 100-degree heat, the brutal stop-and-go traffic, and the hazard-filled roads of North Texas.
Yeah, the fundamental mismatch there is what makes the data so revealing.
That's like oil and water.
Right. I mean, the Z4 is engineered around turbocharged performance and incredibly precise chassis feedback. It's light, and it communicates literally every ripple in the road to the driver.
Which is great on a smooth track.
Exactly. But because the tolerances are so incredibly tight and the chassis is so communicative, the moment a component begins to degrade, the performance drop-off is immediate.
You feel it right away.
Yeah, you feel a failing bushing in a Z4 months before you would ever notice it in like a heavy insulated SUV.
Right, and the Dallas environment is essentially kryptonite for those tight tolerances. I mean, the guide paints this picture of summer afternoons cresting 100 degrees
Oh,
Fahrenheit.
that's brutal.
Plus relentless stop-and-go traffic, which means you have no real airflow going through the radiator, and on top of that, punishing uneven construction
In the
zones.
worst case scenario for a sports car.
It really is. I was reading this and thinking, it's like making a finely tuned marathon runner sprint through a humid obstacle course while wearing a sauna suit.
That is actually a perfect analogy.
But the sheer amount of ambient heat seems like the overarching villain here. So let me ask you this. Is the damage primarily coming from aggressive driving, or is the environment doing the heavy lifting just by the car existing in it?
What's fascinating here is the physical reality of heat cycling. The driving itself is almost secondary to the thermal load.
Wait, really? Just the heat itself?
Yeah. The car is subjected to extreme temperature differentials constantly. I mean, on a typical North Texas day, you might start with a mild morning, right?
Sure.
But by mid-afternoon, the ambient air is over 100 degrees. And when you look at the radiant heat coming off the asphalt, combined with a turbocharged engine running in really tight quarters, the underhood temperatures are astronomical.
It's basically a mobile oven.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in that oven, you have this massive collection of disparate materials. You've got aluminum engine blocks, plastic intake manifolds, rubber gaskets, silicone seals.
And they all react differently to heat.
Right. Every single one of those materials expands at a different rate as it heats up and then contracts at a different rate as it cools down at night.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about the cooling down part.
Yes, the cycle. Think of taking a metal paperclip and just bending it back and forth. You don't have to snap it aggressively in one motion.
You just wiggle it.
Exactly. Just the constant repetitive back and forth generates internal heat, it weakens the structural integrity, and eventually it just fails.
So the temperature swings are basically bending the paperclip on every rubber and plastic component under the hood every single day.
Day in and day out, that constant thermal expansion and contraction accelerates what's called the outgassing of the plasticizers in the rubber.
Meaning it dries out.
Yeah, the materials lose their elasticity, they get brittle. So a valve cover gasket that might easily survive 10 years in a temperate, mild climate, well, it will harden into a brittle piece of plastic and fail in half that time in Dallas.
Which brings us to the invisible wear and tear under the hood. These are the ticking clocks that are degrading, even if the car is just sitting idle in the driveway.
And that's where people get caught off guard.
Right. The guide really highlights oil leaks here, specifically singling out the valve cover gasket, the oil filter housing gasket, and the oil pan.
The big three.
Yeah. And the authors are very adamant. They emphasize that you absolutely cannot dismiss an oil leak on a Z4 as just normal aging.
Which completely goes against how a lot of people treat older cars.
Right. I feel like most people see a drop of oil on the driveway and think, well, it's just a cosmetic nuisance. Just put some cardboard down.
Right. But on a high-performance engine, it's a cascading threat. That oil doesn't just drip straight down onto the driveway.
Where does it go?
Well, it gets blown back by the radiator fan while you're driving. It coats hot exhaust manifolds, which creates noxious smoke that gets pulled into the cabin.
Oh, that's terrible.
It gets worse. An oil filter housing leak will drip directly onto the main serpentine vault.
And oil and rubber don't mix.
No, they do not.
Yeah.
The oil degrades the rubber of the belt rapidly. And when that belt snaps at highway speeds,
you lose power steering.
You lose that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, the broken belt can actually be sucked through the front main seal directly into the engine itself.
Wait, the belt goes inside the engine?
Yes. And it destroys the motor instantly.
So you are basically turning a $50 rubber gasket failure into a completely totaled engine.
Exactly. And the guide points to brake fluid as another totally invisible casualty of this environment.
Yeah, they state that the brake fluid requires servicing every 2 years, entirely independent of mileage, which sounds crazy if you don't drive it much.
It does. But the chemistry of brake fluid dictates that maintenance schedule. Modern brake fluid is polyglycol ether based.
Okay, what does that mean in plain English?
It means it is heavily hygroscopic.
Yeah.
It is chemically designed to actively absorb moisture directly from the air.
But why would you want water in your brake line?
The reason it does this is actually protective. If water got into the lines and didn't mix with the fluid, it would pool at the lowest points, which are the calipers, and cause them to rust from the inside out.
Okay, that makes sense. But absorbing that moisture creates its own massive problem in a humid Texas environment.
It creates a huge thermal vulnerability. See, fresh brake fluid has a boiling point well over 500 degrees.
Plenty high.
Right. But as it absorbs ambient humidity over those 2 years, that boiling point plummets.
Ah, I see where this is going.
Yeah. So if you are sitting in brutal stop-and-go Dallas traffic or doing some spirited driving on a tollway, the heat transferring from the brake pads into the calipers is immense.
Then it hits that new lower boiling point.
Exactly. It can easily exceed the boiling point of that water-contaminated fluid.
And when the fluid boils, it turns into a gas inside the brake lines.
And unlike fluid, gas is highly compressible.
So you step on the brake pedal, and instead of clamping the brake pads onto the rotor,
your foot energy just goes into compressing that pocket of steam. The pedal goes completely soft, it sinks all the way to the floorboards, and the car simply does not stop.
That is terrifying.
It is. And at that point, the thickness of your brake pads and the tread on your tires become completely irrelevant.
Wait, hold on. Let's look at the low mileage illusion here because I'm stuck on this. Say I buy a Z4 purely as a weekend toy, right?
Okay.
And it sits in my climate-controlled garage 90% of the time. The environment isn't actively touching it. How is the fluid absorbing water and the seals drying out if the engine isn't even running?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, time and chemistry do not care about your odometer.
They really don't.
The chemical processes degrading that rubber and contaminating that fluid are happening constantly. It's pulling ambient humidity from the air even if the garage door is closed.
Wow.
But where this low mileage illusion really traps owners is in the vehicle's electronic architecture.
Yes, the battery registration quirk. This is completely mind-blowing to read about.
It catches so many people out. I mean, modern performance cars are essentially mobile data centers.
Right.
The Z4 relies heavily on an incredibly stable voltage supply just to run dozens of onboard computers, sensors, and comfort modules.
And heat cycling destroys batteries.
Exactly. It destroys the chemical composition of lead acid and AGM batteries really quickly in Texas. But the quirk comes into play when you try to replace that dead battery.
Because you can't just drop a new one in and drive away like you could in an older vintage car.
Not at all.
The guide says the car requires a software process called battery registration. And if you skip it, you essentially destroy the new battery in a matter of weeks.
Yes. The vehicle's engine control module utilizes an intelligent battery sensor, so it constantly monitors the internal resistance and degradation of the battery over years.
He's tracking the decay.
Exactly. As an old battery weakens, the car's computer actually commands the alternator to work harder, pumping a much higher voltage into the battery just to keep it functioning.
So the car adapts its charging strategy to compensate for the dying battery.
Right. And if you swap in a fresh battery without plugging into the computer and registering the replacement, the car has absolutely no idea a new battery is there.
Oh, no.
Yeah. The alternator continues its aggressive, high-voltage duty cycle, slamming like 14.8 volts into a brand new battery that does not need it.
So it overcharges it.
It literally boils the internal plates of the new battery, sulfating them almost immediately.
Which leads to those cascading electrical failures the guide talks about.
Right. A damaged battery causes these tiny voltage spikes and drops, and the car's network interprets those drops as critical module failures.
It thinks everything is breaking.
Yes. Suddenly your convertible top gets stuck halfway down, your comfort access doors won't unlock, and your dashboard lights up with transmission faults.
And there's actually nothing mechanically wrong with the transmission.
The hardware isn't broken at all. The computers are just panicking because they are starving for stable voltage.
That is wild. But, you know, those delicate electronic modules aren't just floating in space. They are bolted to a chassis that is taking an absolute physical beating from the local environment.
Oh, the roads.
Yes. Let's transition from the invisible chemistry to the very visible contact points.
Mm-hmm.
Sants, suspension, and convertible systems. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Let's hear it.
The guide points out that to manage the power, many Z4s utilize a staggered tire setup.
Which means the rear tires are significantly wider than the front tires.
Right, which fundamentally changes the maintenance reality of the vehicle. It basically eliminates traditional tire rotations entirely.
Yeah.
It's like buying two different pairs of highly specialized, expensive running shoes for your left and right feet and never being able to swap them when they start wearing down unevenly.
That's a great way to put it. Because the front and rear wheels are different widths and often different diameters, you can't swap them front to back.
You're just stuck.
Yeah, once a tire is mounted to a corner, it is locked into whatever wear pattern the suspension dictates until it dies.
And that suspension is incredibly aggressive.
Very. The Z4 utilizes complex McPherson struts up front and multi-link rear geometry, and it's dialed in with aggressive negative camber.
Meaning the tops of the tires lean inward toward the center of the car.
Right. Now, this provides brilliant grip when you are throwing the car through a corner on a track.
But on a regular road.
When you are driving straight down a notoriously uneven, pothole-riddled Dallas tollway, all the weight of the vehicle is resting on just the inner 2 inches of the tire tread.
Ouch. And the guide highlights how low-profile performance tires face severe risks from this. You get cracked alloy wheels and inner sidewall bubbles.
It's extremely common.
But the suspension itself takes the brunt of it.
And this raises an important question about how drivers actually perceive damage. Think about it. When you hit a pothole with a thick, tall tire on a standard commuter car, what happens?
The rubber sidewall just flexes and absorbs the blow.
Right. But low-profile tires have almost no sidewall flex. So the kinetic energy of that pothole strike transfers directly through the wheel and straight into the aluminum control arms and the rubber suspension bushings.
It just bypasses the tire completely.
Basically. And it permanently deflects the geometry. A single harsh impact can tear a fluid-filled bushing or bend a control arm by just 2 millimeters.
Just 2 millimeters? It doesn't sound like much.
It's tiny, but that tiny deflection throws the alignment completely out of specification.
But the driver wouldn't necessarily notice that immediately, right?
Usually they don't. Because the car is so well insulated and the steering is heavily power assisted, the driver might just turn up the radio to ignore the slightly harsh ride quality.
Meanwhile, that 2 millimeter deflection, combined with the staggered setup and that negative camber we talked about, is basically taking a cheese grater to the inside of the tire.
It will scrub the inner tread of a $400 performance tire right down to the metal cords in a matter of weeks.
Wow.
By the time the driver actually realizes there's a vibration issue, the tires are completely ruined and the suspension components require total replacement.
Just from one bad pothole. But it isn't just the underside of the car taking a beating. The roof is a massive vulnerability, too.
Oh, the convertible top.
Yeah, we are talking about Texas rain events here, which can drop inches of water in a single hour. The guide details the convertible top drains, which feels like an afterthought until it literally destroys the car.
Right. The physical mechanics of a folding hardtop or soft top are complex. But the failure point is almost always the plumbing.
Because the water has to go somewhere.
Exactly. The car has this intricate system of rubber drain tubes and cowls designed to route heavy rain away from the cabin and channel it safely to the ground.
But Dallas is covered in dust, pollen, and leaves.
And those leaves make their way into the cowl area. They break down and essentially form a compost plug inside the narrow rubber drain tubes.
A compost plug? That sounds awful.
It is. The next time a torrential downpour hits, those water channels just fill up instantly.
And the water just spills over the internal bulkheads. The guide points out that this water intrudes into the cabin, soaking the carpets and causing these awful, musty odors.
Which is bad enough.
Right. But the catastrophic risk is water flowing backward into the trunk wells.
Because where do engineers put the heaviest components to achieve perfect weight distribution in a sports car?
In the trunk.
Exactly. The main battery, the audio amplifiers, the convertible top hydraulic pump, and several major computer modules are all just sitting in the lowest points of the trunk well.
So a clogged rubber drain tube basically turns a rainstorm into an overflowing bathtub.
Yep, a bathtub that completely submerges thousands of dollars of unsealed electronic equipment.
It is the perfect illustration of how ignoring a piece of organic debris, just a leaf, can lead to a total electrical loss.
It's all connected.
Which brings us to the core philosophy of this entire guide. Having established all these hyper-specific ways the environment dismantles the machine, the authors pivot to the philosophical difference between two concepts.
Maintenance versus repair.
Exactly. It seems like a subtle shift, but it's huge.
It is the absolute dividing line between controlling the narrative of the vehicle and letting the environment dictate the terms to you.
The source spells it out beautifully. Maintenance is a planned action. You are actively intervening to prevent normal wear from crossing the threshold into failure.
Right.
Whereas repair is entirely reactive.
Yeah.
You are fixing a catastrophic failure that has already occurred.
And the brutal truth they present is that almost all major Z4 repairs are just the consequence of skipped maintenance.
Give me an example.
Well, take a turbocharger. A failed turbocharger doesn't usually fail spontaneously due to some factory defect.
Right.
It fails because the oil lubricating its internal bearings was degraded by heat, it lost its viscosity, and it wasn't changed frequently enough to handle the thermal load of a Dallas summer.
So the skipped oil change directly murdered the turbocharger.
Precisely. And the margin for error is razor thin.
Yeah, they describe this danger zone when it comes to the cooling system. If you get a dashboard coolant warning light on a 100-degree afternoon, the window between that light illuminating and the engine block permanently warping is terrifyingly short.
You do not play around with that.
The guide says you don't even drive to the next exit or try to limp home. You shut the engine off immediately, pull over on the shoulder, and turn it off.
Because the ambient environment provides zero thermal relief. In those conditions, the water pump and the cooling fans are already operating at maximum capacity just to maintain baseline engine temperatures.
So they have nothing left to give.
Nothing. If an expansion tank cracks or a radiator hose develops just a tiny pinhole leak, the system loses pressure, the coolant boils, and the internal engine temperature spikes exponentially in seconds.
Wow. So how you manage this threat depends largely on the era of your Z4, according to the guide. They break down the approach for older versus newer models.
Right, because the technology changed drastically.
Yeah. Older analog Z4s require a technician to physically interact with the car. You know, taking a pry bar to the control arm bushings to check for deflection.
Manually squeezing coolant hoses to feel for soft spots.
Exactly. Looking for micro cracks in the serpentine belt with a flashlight.
They rely on the physical integrity of the materials, which requires human intuition and experience to assess.
But the newer models utilize condition-based service systems, or CBS. The car's software continuously monitors its own fuel consumption, RPMs, and component data to calculate when fluids, spark plugs, or brakes need replacing.
It's incredibly sophisticated.
It is, but reading this made me wonder, if the car has this highly advanced algorithm calculating its own health, why can't I just wait for the dashboard to tell me it's sick?
I hear that all the time.
Right. Why do I need a human technician digging around if the car is basically a computer?
Because the algorithm completely lacks environmental context. Relying purely on the CBS dashboard warnings in an extreme climate is a massive gamble.
How so?
Well, the sensors and algorithms are programmed with factory parameters, and those parameters are optimized for a temperate, mild European climate.
Oh.
The computer cannot feel the radiant heat of the asphalt in Texas. It assumes the rubber and plastic are aging at a standard mild rate.
It doesn't know it lives in Dallas.
Exactly the problem.
Yeah.
The CBS system only knows when a component has already failed or crossed a highly critical threshold.
It's reactive.
Very. A proactive technician, however, looks at the whole picture. They will spot the early signs of a leaky water pump. Maybe just a slight white crust of dried coolant weeping from a seal.
Something a sensor can't see.
Right, and they'll spot it long before the pump fails and triggers the warning light. The computer tells you what is broken today. The technician tells you what will break in 6 months.
Which naturally leads to the debate over who you actually trust to make those predictions. The guide offers a really interesting breakdown between utilizing a dealership versus an independent shop.
Which is a big decision for owners.
Now, Autoscope, as the authors of the guide, obviously advocates for independent European specialists, but their underlying logic is really worth examining. Dealerships are undeniably necessary for warranty claims, factory recalls, and, you know, major software updates.
Absolutely. You need them for that. But the business model of a dealership often revolves around moving vehicles through the service bay as quickly as possible, just addressing the immediate complaint.
Right. They're fixing the one thing you came in for. From Autoscope's perspective, independent shops that possess the same dealer-level diagnostic software offer a totally different model of transparency.
They have more time to look at the big picture.
Exactly. They argue the key metric of a good technician is how they prioritize the data. They should be able to separate immediate safety needs like a weeping brake line or a failing water pump from long-term cosmetic or monitoring items.
And they should do it without utilizing high-pressure sales tactics.
Right. The goal is to build a sustainable management plan for the lifespan of the machine, rather than treating every single service visit like an emergency room triage where everything is a crisis.
It's about a partnership, really.
Exactly. So what does this all mean for you listening at home? Bringing it back to the big picture, owning a highly complex, finely tuned machine isn't just a financial transaction where you purchase the hardware and expect it to serve you endlessly.
It takes work.
It is an active management of the relationship between that machine and the environment that is actively trying to destroy it.
You have to respect the fact that the environment is an aggressive participant in the degradation of your systems. It's not passive.
And whether you drive a turbocharged roadster with an aggressive negative camber setup, or a standard daily commuter, or honestly, whether you just manage delicate, sensitive projects in your professional life, the underlying truth remains identical.
Proactive always wins.
Always. Proactive maintenance, taking the time to understand the invisible stressors, the thermal loads, the tiny deflections, and planning for them always beats reactive repair.
Because understanding the chemistry and the physics allows you to stay ahead of the failure curve instead of just reacting to the damage.
Which leaves me with a final thought to ponder, building on the trajectory we've discussed today. We started by talking about how the environment battles the machine, but as these condition-based service systems grow more advanced,
like CBS systems.
Right. And as vehicles become increasingly defined by their software rather than their hardware, at what point does the car actually understand its own mechanical mortality better than the driver sitting behind the wheel?
Oh, we are rapidly approaching an era of predictive failure analysis.
Right. And if the software knows the local environment is brutal and it calculates that your brake fluid has absorbed too much moisture or your turbocharger oil has lost its viscosity, are we approaching a future where a car might just refuse to start entirely?
It's completely possible.
Not because a physical part is broken yet, but because the algorithm determines that your delayed maintenance combined with a 100-degree afternoon mathematically guarantees a catastrophic failure.
That's a wild thought.
Think about who is really in control the next time you turn the key. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.